All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a jam-packed show this week. I just want to get into it right away. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with the entire cast of the play The Brothers Size, and it's going to be a really interesting conversation. I saw the play recently, and it poses a lot of questions that actually flow from and fit into the rest of the show. And at the middle part of the show, we'll be talking with Carl Dix. And we're going to be talking about the raid that happened in Harlem on June 4th, a raid on Harlem housing projects by 400 heavily armed cops that broke down doors, put guns to the heads of grandmothers and toddlers, and generally resurrected the whole image of slavery and the reality of what life is for the masses of black people in this society today. We'll be talking with Carl Dix about that horrendous and savage and inhumane raids. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's reported from Iraq, Iran, Lebanon, Turkey, Syria, and Palestine. Now, we talked with Larry last week as all this stuff in Iraq was breaking out, and I wanted to have him back because we really needed to dig into this. You know, on June 10th, armed fighters of the Sunni jihadist group ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and it's sometimes the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, took over Iraq's northern province of Nineveh and its capital, Mosul, a city of over 1 million people, driving out the armed forces of the U.S.-installed Iraqi government of Maliki. And Obama has been talking seriously about various kinds of things going on, about various kinds of ways the U.S. was going to have to step in. And he announced that, among other things, he is sending, 300 military advisors to Iraq, and that's on top of the 275 he had announced he was sending there before in order to protect U.S. personnel in Iraq. Joining us to talk all about this is Larry Everest. Larry, how are you?
Hey, Michael. Good. Good. Good to be with you.
You were about to say, hey, Larry, how are you?
I know. Well, I need to ask myself that question, too, but that's a different conversation.
Well, I'll tell you, in the world today, man, it's a conversation that I think everybody's got to be posing in some ways. This is deep now, right? Because actually we do all have to be questioning who the hell we are when we aren't just like the pitchforks and the torches in the town square saying, enough, this can't go on anymore. Let's talk about what's happening, all right? As I said, Obama announced that they'll be sending 300 military advisors to Iraq, and there's already warships positioned in the region, a whole lot of other stuff going on. What do you make of this?
Well, I think the key, look, this was not the U.S. plan. Obama hoped to be able to extricate the U.S. from ground wars in the Middle East and Central Asia, which obviously hadn't worked out as planned, and shift U.S. attention not to leave the Middle East, but to try to hold things down to a low boil while the U.S. could pay more attention to Asia, the Pacific, China, and so on and so forth. But again, not leaving the region, but I think what's happened now is that the collapse, at least in Mosul, of the Iraqi army was a big shock, and the control of northwest Iraq and parts of Syria by jihadist forces, as well as there are a lot of other Sunni tribal and ex-Ba'athist forces involved. It's a complicated mix. So I think the issue of the stability of the structures of U.S. dominance, actually the state structures in the region, not simply the potential for the Iraqi state to collapse, but the potential for this to spread into Jordan, perhaps somewhat into Turkey, to further escalate the situation in Syria, even impact Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. I think this is what trumped the other concerns and is the main concern, and this is why Obama's taken the steps you mentioned, and there may be others we don't know about, but there's also the massive infusion of intelligence, drones, and warning that there could be the so-called targeted strikes. This is a very significant move because they're putting their feet in the water, so to speak. What happens if these so-called targeted strikes have the same impact they've had elsewhere of further enraging masses of people and contributing to this whole dynamic we're seeing of what the U.S. does actually fuels Islamic fundamentalism and jihadism across the region? Or what happens if U.S. personnel are involved in combat? And then the U.S. is forced to respond to that. What happens if at this point, the fighting's within 30 or 40 miles of Baghdad, and they're still apparently fighting for the main oil refinery in Iraq. So, you know, if the battle turns against Maliki even further, what might the U.S. do? But I think it's this question of the regional instability and not allowing this ISIS, ISIL, and other associated forces to really gain the kind of a foothold that they have at the moment.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Now, Larry, really, it's really just wraps your gut up in the knots, man. And there's all these people are out there and they're trying to explain, okay, where did this come from? Why did it happen? And actually what they're saying, you listen to it and they're dragging everybody out. I mean, they got Cheney dragged out from the crypt. They got all kinds of people out there. Tom Hayden's, you know, writing these on his blog, these the little different things and all. But they're all trying to say that in one way or another, it's not our fault is part of it, or it's Bush's fault, or some of them saying, you know, it's like a little bit like that line from the movie Chinatown. Jake, it's Chinatown. And that's enough of an explanation. All right. You know, that there's just the mysteries of the Middle East. You've commented that all this stuff about trying to say that it's not the U.S.'s fault, it's not our fault, the way they would put it, is actually pretty outrageous. Why?
You know, you hardly even know where to begin with this, but let's begin with what Obama's described as an honorable and heroic effort by the military and the sacrifices of the U.S. in Iraq. No, the U.S. went to war in Iraq based on deliberate and conscious lies. They knew there was no WMD, and it was a war for empire and imperialism. They had a whole agenda of wiping the slate clean and turning Iraq into a platform for U.S. global capitalism and for U.S. military and political power to reshape the whole Middle East. That's what it was about. That's what I document in my book. And in the course of doing that, the U.S. not only killed over 120,000 Iraqis in combat, but between 600 and 1,000 and 1.4 million Iraqis have died as a result of the impacts of the war and the ongoing civil war that broke out. 4.5 million, and now probably over 5 million in the wake of this latest fighting, have been driven from their homes. 2 million women are now widows thanks to this war. 4 million Iraqis injured. Plus, the U.S. destroyed a nationalist government, not a sectarian, not a government. It was a repressive, reactionary government, but it wasn't a religious fundamentalist government, and basically excluded Sunnis from any significant position in the government, and therefore really helped create and fuel sectarianism. And they supported the Dawa party and the Maliki government as they were committing vicious crimes against humanity, against the Sunni population in Baghdad, and waging a war of ethnic cleansing. That's what the U.S. has done. And, of course, it's just rank American chauvinism and thinly disguised racism saying, oh, you know, we've done wonderful thing, but it's these unruly natives, so to speak, that just don't know how to do democracy or something. It's outrageous.
Well, you know what, Larry? I mean, that's why I was bringing up the thing about Hayden, because I was really knocked back in my seat when I read what he was saying. He said, after laying out what's going on and the whole idea, he was one of the people, I think, that was, you know, laying out this whole thing. It was sort of like, who knows how it happened? It had a lot to do with Republicans, and Obama is really, really suffering from the blowback of all this and had nothing to do with it. And he actually says, look, the thing for people to do, the main thing, the most important thing people have to do right now is they have to create this narrative that will stop the war hawks from blaming Obama. Really? That's the main thing that people have to do in the face of this kind of crisis that you're talking about and what's happening to the people in that part of the world?
Right. And the whole thing's ridiculous in terms of, no, it's not Obama's fault. It's the neocons. It's Bush's war. It's not Bush's war. It's an imperialist war. It isn't an oil war. It isn't a neocon war. It isn't Bush's war. It's an imperialist war. Look, this war grew out of nearly 70 years of U.S. imperialist domination of the whole region, including Iraq. I walked through this whole history in my book, starting in the 1920s. And this involved strangling this entire region, turning it into an oil spigot for the world at the expense of the people, coups, military interventions, supporting all these tyrants, monarchs, and dictators, and including Saddam Hussein, helping him get to power. All of the support for Israel and its crimes against the people, all of this has been done with support from both parties. Why? Because it's a core element of the functioning of U.S. capitalism imperialism. Oil's the lifeblood of empire. It's been a crucial element of the profitability of all of U.S. capital, of controlling the global economy, of wielding leverage and power over other imperialists. That's why they have all supported this.
Mm-hmm.
It's essential to the system. And look, there was a logic, but the problem was that this regional order was coming unglued by the new millennium, by 2000. There were problems. There were contradictions. And so after September 11th, 2001, this strategy of reshuffling the whole deck, reordering the whole situation in the Middle East, waging a 20-year long war to so-called drain the swamp and transform this region into a bastion for U.S. imperialism, that was the strategy adopted, voted for by John Kerry, voted for by Hillary Clinton, and that involved going into Iraq and doing, as I said, getting rid of the Sunni army, really just completely raising the structure, defeating Arab nationalism for once and for all, and trying to create a regime to their liking. So there was a logic to this, and the dominant elements of the ruling class supported it. Didn't work out as planned.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Now, let me ask you this, because it's also there's a lot of ways that what's being focused on is who knows why it happens, the clash between religious sects and all this other stuff. And you've talked about both you were talking about a little bit last week, but in general, and Bob Avakian, has the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has made an analysis of one of the things that's really shaping, or the big thing that's shaping the world right now, is this clash between two outmoded strata. You know, why don't you talk about that?
Well, this is important, and Avakian goes into it in both Bringing Forward Another Way, which is available at revcom.us, and his book, Away With All Gods. And he identifies that what's going on here, and again, we're speaking here of Islamic fundamentalists who have a vision of imposing a strict interpretation of Islam on all of society as the legal structure, the ideological structure, the social. We're not just speaking here about people who are simply Muslims or so on. It's the difference between progressive Christians here, but then they're also Christian fundamentalists. So we're talking about fundamentalists here. He analyzes the global rise of Islamic fundamentalism, particularly Islamic fundamentalism, in the workings of imperialism, also contributing as the defeat of the communist revolutions after Mao died in 1976 created a political vacuum, and the different machinations of imperialism. But we've got to a point where he identifies that what we're looking at in this battle between imperialism and these Islamic fundamentalist forces like the Taliban or like Al-Qaeda or like the Islamic Republic of Iran or this ISIL or ISIS group. And of course, there are differences among those. But broadly speaking, this is historically outmoded strata among colonized and oppressed humanity. In other words, colonized countries like Afghanistan and Iran up against outmoded ruling strata, the imperialist system, which he notes does far, far more damage to the planet. But then this is what I think is so important. These reactionary poles reinforce each other even while opposing each other. And if you side with either one of these outmoded, you end up strengthening both. And this is what we've seen for the last, 13-plus years, that this so-called war on terror, which is actually a war for greater empire, this is exactly what's happened. The reactionary force of imperialism has given rise to more in many different ways, in particular the outrage so many people feel at the crimes of imperialism. But this has fueled jihadism. It's fueled Islamic fundamentalism. Look at the situation. ISIL isn't simply a small band of fighters doing this, that, or the other thing. It's got control of extensive territory.
We're talking with Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. All right, Larry, I'm going to ask you one more question, and it's kind of a compound question, and we only got about maybe 5 minutes to do it. So let me put it to you this way. When we started the discussion, you immediately got into a pretty good discussion of the character of the crisis that's rocking the Middle East and rocking the world right now. And what I wanted to do was return to that in a certain way. I wanted you to talk about, look, this crisis, it is something that's really like tearing apart the Middle East, and it also is having an impact worldwide. There's a real crisis in the world. And those two things are playing off of one another. They're reinforcing one another. They're interconnected. I wanted you to talk about the character of this crisis, the dangers that are posed. And then after that, I want you to talk about what you think people should do in the face of this.
Well, I think it certainly is a very profound crisis. Just starting with the Middle East, what we are talking about is national boundaries and state structures that have been in existence nearly 100 years since World War I, and which have been the foundation of U.S. control and dominance of this region. And let's not forget also that this control for the U.S. has been essential for its global power and empire. It's been a central part of this. And the crisis that's happening in the Middle East, and I'm going to be writing about this at revcom.us, so stay tuned. The crisis there is also interacting very much with the food crisis, with the environmental crisis, and with the global economic crisis. So these things are reverberating that way. And the other element that this is interacting with on the global playing field is the rivalry between different imperialist and big capitalist powers, particularly Russia and China. Let's not forget that this war on terror, this whole thing that started in October 2001 with the invasion of Afghanistan, was aimed to make this empire stronger. They have failed. It has made this empire weaker. It is riven with contradiction. And in particular, it has given both Russia and China the need and the opportunity to expand their reach and limited U.S. freedom. And this is one of the real conundrums. Obama wants to pivot to China. He keeps getting sucked into the Middle East. And I think the take-home message of this for people is these imperialists are not all-powerful. This is not their plan for how they wanted things to work out. They are not all-knowing. And in that context, revolution is an actual possibility if those of us who understand that this is really what's needed act with urgency, and other people who care about the situation and hate to see the people suffering so much really find out about this possibility of revolution. And in terms of what people can do, I'm going to suggest a few different things. One, certainly read our coverage at revcom.us. I have a new piece up basically saying hell no to any U.S. intervention, any U.S. military escalation. And I think it was very important that people do protest and continue to protest. And their plans for a day of or a day after any U.S. bombing. That's very important. But the other article I want to point people to is called, in this issue of the paper, is called Making Advances Toward Revolution. And people can read this and really get a sense of what the strategy for revolution, the Revolutionary Communist Party, is implementing. And it's kind of summed up in the slogan, prepare the ground, prepare the people, and prepare the vanguard. Get ready for the time when millions can be led to go all out for revolution, all out with a real chance to win. And it does talk about the crisis moment that is gathering in the U.S. and around the world and goes into that. But finally, I think what this clash of reactionary forces in the Middle East that we've talked about really highlights is the need to bring forward a different way that is neither imperialism nor Islamic fundamentalism. And in that spirit and context, I really encourage people to read Communism, the Beginning of a New Stage, a manifesto from the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. This is exactly what it says. It is a theoretical framework and foundation for a new liberating stage of revolution, socialism, and communism. It's based on Bob Avakian's new synthesis of all this. And I just can't stress enough the importance of people spreading this by social media out into the world so people in this region can look for a liberating alternative, not these two reactionary forces.
All right, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about a horrific raid by 400 heavily armed cops on Harlem housing projects. So stay tuned.
What we going to do about the man in blue? What we going to do? What we going to do about the man in blue?
Right, that's What We Gonna Do About the Man in Blue, Part 1 from Youth Brigade. Very appropriate for the next section of our show today. On June 4th, more than 400 heavily armed cops broke down doors, put guns to the heads of grandmothers and toddlers, pulled a teenage girl out of bed, and handcuffed her face down on the floor, gunpoint in her underwear. Dozens of young men, aged 15 to 30, were dragged out of their homes in chains while the commandos destroyed the belongings of their families, laughing and talking about what they were going to have for lunch. This was a massive police raid in Harlem, New York, following the indictment of 103 individuals based solely on Facebook posts and phone calls recorded over 4 years. We're going to be talking with Carl Dix about all that. Carl Dix is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he has been at the center of the protests of these raids, and he's joining us to talk about this today. Carl, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, well, let's jump into this real quick because I want to get as much done as we can. This is such a horror. Describe to people what happened in a little bit more detail than I did.
Yeah, I mean, here it is. It's pre-dawn on June 4th. Helicopters are hovering over these housing projects. And you've got these 400 cops in body armor with military assault weapons and battering rams, which they use to break down people's doors. And it really reminded me of the raids that U.S. troops carried out in Vietnam back in the 60s or in Afghanistan or Iraq today. And then the scene of dozens of young men being dragged out in chains, it was like these were slavers going up and down the coast in Africa back in the day, capturing Africans to drag them off to slavery, or slave chasers catching runaway slaves and dragging them back to slavery. This is what it looked like up in Harlem. And, I mean, it was horrific, and it was a real concentration of the criminalization of black youth, because I've been reviewing the indictments, and the indictments are for a conspiracy. And the overwhelming majority of overt acts to carry out this conspiracy are posts on Facebook or YouTube that the young men put up.
We're going to get into that in a minute, Carl. I want to actually read people a little section because I think your description was good, but I want to add to it because I was really moved by an opening paragraph in an article in a Revolution newspaper. And it was the article was basically the point it was they want to stop this whole generation was, I guess, the title of it. And they say, this is a woman resident of one of the housing projects in Harlem. She said, I woke up, opened my bedroom door, and there was a gun in my face. Nobody knocked on my door. My son was not in the apartment. They told me, shut the F up and put my hands up, put handcuffs on me, smashed my face into a wall. They never told me what they were there for. They wouldn't let my 7-year-old grandson come out of the room, who was in there screaming. They told me they will get him later. They tore my house up. Just to give people a sense of what Carl's talking about in terms of the slavers going up and down and the rest of this. And when you look at the pictures of the people, you hear the descriptions of how these youth were brought out in chains. It really does hearken, you know, conjure up the question of slavery.
No, exactly. And to just give you a sense of this thing of criminalization of the youth, the Daily News, a local tabloid, ran a article called Gang Related, which was just a brief text thing under a picture of 7, 8, and 9-year-old kids playing in a playground. And it labeled them future gang members and wannabe gang members. That's their view on the youth, and it ties in directly with this cop saying he'll be back for the 7-year-old later.
That's it. You know, just incredible. So let's talk about this, the justifications for the raid that you were starting to get into. As I understand it, the indictments that they brought down were based on basically trawling through mountains of Facebook, you know, braggadocio, telephone, cell phone calls, other kinds of social media. Talk about that some.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I reviewed the indictment again this morning. It's a conspiracy indictment. And the overwhelming majority of overt acts, because when you charge somebody with conspiracy, then you have to cite the overt acts that they carried out. And it came down to posting things on Facebook, putting up YouTubes, and making phone calls. That's what the overt acts were. There were a few criminal activities that they allege that people carried out, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But mostly what they're saying is that these young men put up posts giving props to other young men in the neighborhood that they hung out with, dissing young men who hung out in a project across the way that was a rival area that they did have beefs with, boasting about what they did, the kind of stuff that goes on in rap songs. And some of them were even rap songs. And this is what they're bringing in as evidence of a criminal conspiracy.
You know, Carl, there's a point that gets made in one of the articles in Revolution that talks about what other group of people, if you think about it, what other group of people, what other section of society would this kind of stuff on in social media actually be the basis for a horrific pogromish style, Nazi pogromish style raid?
Yeah, and it does come down to having criminalized Black and Latino youth. I mean, the head of the NYPD, someone that a lot of your listeners will have some familiarity with, Chief Pig Bratton, went on the media after the raids and said, those who choose this lifestyle will give you more of the same. See, and he's saying this to people who, frankly, did not choose the life that they live. It was enforced on them, put upon them by this capitalist system in the very way that it works, because they didn't choose to grow up in neighborhoods where there's no legitimate means to raise a family or to survive. They didn't choose to be in neighborhoods that where the educational system was geared to fail the youth. They didn't choose that. That came about because of the way this capitalist system works. And they did not choose to live in an America that would approach them and treat them as criminals because of the color of their skin. Again, that comes down to the conscious policies adopted by the rulers of this system.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about a horrendous pogromish Nazi raid on housing projects in Harlem on June 4th. Now, Carl, one of the things I was thinking about in relation to this and preparing for talking with you, you know, just a couple days ago, there was a massive raid here in Los Angeles, and it involved 1,300. Now, a lot of people don't know that it was 1,300. Yeah. Well, a lot of people, that wasn't in the LA Times that it had, the raid was in there, but not that it was 1,300 FBI and police forces in this area. And they raided a certain section of sort of an in-between Watts and South, you know, part of South Central. They raided that, and the excuse they used was, and they busted, I can't remember what it was, 50 people or so, and the basic excuse that they used for terrorizing this neighborhood was that, well, all these people were drug dealers and doing great harm to the neighborhood. We were just stepping in to take care of this. And, you know, it's kind of heavy because in a similar way, that's what they couch all this stuff in, these attacks that they bring down, these racist assaults, whether they're the massive raids or whether it's the constant stop and frisk that they had, all these kinds of things. This is something that people really have to go up against. And I think what you're just talking about in terms of what choices are we talking about in a society like this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And part of the thing that this brought back to me was the way in which large numbers of people were like the election of Bill de Blasio to be the new mayor of New York and to end the history of Michael Bloomberg and before him, Rudy Giuliani, Republican mayors. That was going to mean that the NYPD was going to stop treating black and Latino youth like criminals. And, you know, I told people at the time, not going to happen, because this isn't a question of who's in the mayor's office, but the way this system works and what its needs are, and that it needs to exercise and enforce tight control over sections of people that they have no future for. People got a taste of that when de Blasio reached in to get a Giuliani retread like Bill Bratton, whose entire career has been based upon the criminalization of black and Latino neighborhoods, and especially the youth. And this really pushed it in people's faces. But now it's a big fight to get people to not swallow the propaganda that this is about crime, because that's the way it's been presented in virtually all of the media. That's beginning to be gone against by the fact that dozens of residents have begun to mobilize, have come out to speak out, and have wanted to tell the truth. Because we had one meeting and a TV station came to it, and we asked the TV station not to record people unless they wanted to, and then we asked people, did they want to say something to TV? Because we didn't want to put people in the position of unknowingly and not wanting to being on TV. And most of the people there wanted to speak to the cameras, wanted to identify themselves as residents, and wanted to talk about what was done with to them. So people are standing up there, organizing to resist this, and we're working with them to do that. And for the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, it really fits into what we were doing anyway, because we had issued a call for a month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation for October of this year. And here the NYPD gives us a concentrated expression of all of that, the mass incarceration, the police terror, the repression, and the criminalization. So it was something that we felt we had to be a part of resisting and getting with the residents who had been abused so horribly to fight against that.
Well, one of the things that you were also, I think, bringing into this, and I can't remember whether I read it from something you said or something that was in Revolution Newspaper or on revcom.us, where it basically made the point that this raid is sort of a coming out party for the whole new policing strategy of the de Blasio-Bratton gang. Explain that, because you talked about, okay, didn't really expect, you know, how you had warned people, look, this is not going to happen. De Blasio is not going to, suddenly everything's going to be like daisies growing up in the ghettos and people are going to be visiting officer friendly and all this other stuff. But there was actually this, there was going to be another continuation. And this is actually a coming out party for the new policing strategy of the de Blasio-Bratton gang.
Yes, because the strategy that they have adopted, they've kind of said, okay, stop and frisk, that's behind us. We're not going to do very much of that. What we're going to do is what they call smarter policing, more concentrated on the areas where violent crime is a big problem. And they call it Operation Crew Cut, which is supposed to be aimed at violent gang members. And in their rendition, the youth in this neighborhood, who have nicknames for each other and call themselves different kinds of things, you know, like money boys and different things like that, well, they're all gang members, they're all violent, and most of them are criminals, and they sweep in and grab up dozens of them. This is not the first raid they've done in New York City under Operation Crew Cuts, but it is the largest and the most vicious that they've carried out. And see, this is their new approach to it, and these violent crime areas actually sink in with the areas where they concentrated a lot of the stop and frisk. So it is a continuation of the criminalization of Black and Latino youth, just doing it under a different name with some different tactics, but it comes down to the same thing.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about a horrendous, pogromish Nazi raid on housing projects in Harlem on June 4th. Now, Carl, you and Cornel West have issued a statement condemning this raid. Can we talk a little bit about that statement and then what you see in terms of actually doing? What do you see people doing?
Yeah, we felt when this came down, we needed to go to people and be a part of resisting this. And I was a part of doing that. And at the same time, we needed to reach out to people in different sections of society, people who don't experience this kind of mistreatment directly, but who know it's going on and oppose it. And Cornel was one of the first people that I thought of in relation to that. I talked with him about it, and I was going to be at a press conference later that week. He couldn't be there because he was going to be halfway across the country speaking somewhere, but he wanted to be in the house. So he said, how about if we do up a statement? And in that statement, we called out the way in which they have criminalized our young people and that this amounts to a system that has no future for them, that fears them, and because of that having no future and that fear, are treating them all like criminals, and that we stood with them. And then the other thing that we brought out in this statement is that what motivates both of us to do that is because we love these young people. And see, in saying that, we ain't saying that we're with everything that they all do, because there are some criminal activity involved in this conspiracy that they're talking about. Not that much, because like I said, it's mostly posting stuff up on Facebook, YouTube, and things like that. But there are some young people who are involved in fighting each other, beating each other up, even firing shots at each other. Well, that's stuff that people got to get out of. That's no good. It's not helping out anybody. And in fact, it's a part of how the system goes about controlling oppressed people. It gets them divided up and fighting against each other. So in going to people, I've also directed a message to the youth. You all got to get out of some of the bad stuff that you're into and get into something else. And in saying that, I say, look, I know what's the backdrop for this. I know that the system has created conditions that drive you to this stuff, but it is no darn good. You got to get out of it, and you got to get with the movement for revolution and movements of resistance that are fighting against it. Change how you look at stuff, get with this movement and help fight this stuff. And you got to come together in this. There's no reason for people who live on one side of the street to be fighting people who live on the other side of the street when you're all in the same condition, being oppressed by the same system, being treated like criminals by the same police. You need to stand together against that.
All right, Carl, we got about 1 minute left, and I want you to tell people quickly where they can find out information about all the things you've been talking about, and including the month of resistance coming up in October.
Okay, the things to do, go to the website revcom.us. That's revcom.us. You can find the statement from me and Cornel, much more coverage on the raids. Go to the website, and also go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .net. And you could also find about, we're going to court. The next court date is going to be Monday, very early in the morning. There's going to be a rally and press conference, and we're going to be pursuing that in that framework, as well as working to unite people in these different neighborhoods to stand together and resist, and to bring others outside of these neighborhoods into this fight.
All right,
we're going to be doing that as part of building up to and preparing for the October month of resistance to mass incarceration.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again soon.
All right, thank you, Mike.
Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about the just inhumane, the Nazi raid on Harlem housing projects in New York City on June 4th. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with, yep, get ready, the entire cast of The Brothers Size. Welcome back. And that is Uprising from Wadada Leo Smith and Ed Blackwell. Thought it was kind of appropriate for everything we've been talking about today. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you thought I was kidding. I do have the entire cast of this great play that I saw the other night. And the play is just, it's by, I don't know if I'll get his name right, Terrell Alvin McCraney.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay. And the play is The Brothers Size. And joining me today, sitting here and telling me, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, I've got to, because I was so mesmerized by everything that happened, and I'm looking at you two guys, and I'm thinking, okay, I know them, but you're actually the guys in the, you're Ogun and you're Oshusi.
Yes, that's right.
And you, Elegba. Okay, but really who you are is Gilbert Glenn Brown.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Matthew Hancock.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank
and
you.
Theo Perkins. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I want to jump into this play for people who don't know. And it's possible you can see this play in many parts of the country. And I was actually really encouraged by that, to see how many places this is actually played in different, mm-hmm. Theaters around the country. I want you to give people a sense of the play, though, because it was not what I expected, so it's part of a trilogy. I missed the first one, but the second one, which you can see independent of seeing the first mm-hmm. one, because it's just a killer in its own right, but why don't one of you explain who it is? And maybe we'll go with, let me see. Gilbert, we'll go with you, because you play Ogun and you are like the boss, all right?
Yes, he is.
Well, the show, The Brothers Size, revolves around the two brothers, Ogun and Oshusi. Oshusi has just returned from prison to his brother's home, Ogun, his older brother's home, Ogun, who's a mechanic. He's holding down the fort, and his brother comes back in, and he's made some choices in his life, and he's trying to figure out what direction he wants to go in, and Oakland's trying to guide him. But Elegba shows up, who's a friend of his from jail, who's kind of presenting him with some other options that might be a little questionable.
You gonna let him talk about you like that, man?
Hey, everyone has the right to their own opinion.
Let me jump into this because I think it's really what happened in this play. Well, one, there's, and I know a lot of people said this, but I really felt this thing of, it was almost like sort of the next generation of August Wilson in the mm-hmm. house in a certain mm-hmm. sense. You know? Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Well, from what I know, Terrell.
You have to say who you are.
I'm Matthew Hancock and I play Oshusi. Terrell actually studied under August Wilson at his time in Yale. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where he got the three cycle, the culture of the characters. So there are a lot of similarities between him and August Wilson. Yeah. His voice is probably one of the most profound right now in theater. So it's great to be working with his words, for sure.
And he definitely took from him the idea of ritual and mm-hmm. tradition mm-hmm. and family in his works.
Yeah, and also, the thing that got me, and Theo, I'll ask you this, because mm-hmm. you play Elegba.
Yes.
And who's actually one of the you guys are really, I really was into your characters, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you were kind of like that, you were like Look, I grew up in a Catholic school, right? And you were like the snake in the tree. Because and there's something to that, because again, with the Wilson influence, the fact that you guys all had Yoruba names, and those names actually were connected to Yoruba religious beliefs and all this, and yours, Elegbe, was
a trickster.
You say that so flatly, man.
Yeah, trickster. It's fun playing a character. I mean, Terrell leaves a lot of space for actors to sort of like play in between the lines, and that's what I mostly enjoy when I work, when I don't speak, and what I'm doing when I don't speak. So yeah, Legba is known as a trickster. Like Gil said, I present Oshusi, a lot of choices. There's no right or wrong, but my ultimate goal is to get him out of town, to set him free.
We're going to talk about that in a minute, because the other thing that I wanted to talk about in relation to this whole thing of the language and the flow, and it's actually like I was thinking about this thing about somebody's like, you know, when he was traveling around the country and even going to the South and staying in New Orleans for a while and some of these like places that you would see with these rivers, these big full rivers that and the flow. And I just watched the use of the language and the way it flowed. And it was just, I mean, everything.
Like poetry.
Poetry and song. I mean, it was just like there was an incredible beauty and power to the language itself. Whether you were arguing from beneath a car or standing in the background and enticing, you know, which is kind of, there was a beautiful, or waking up and saying, I don't want to be awake, man. I don't want to go to work. These are all things that these guys have said at one point or another in the play. So let's talk about that flow of the language, because it was really very, very heavy.
It's definitely our director, Shirley Jo Finney, she would call it, you know, playing the licks. It's a song. It's one long song. And she's our conductor. And I think she did an excellent job of orchestrating us to play the music of the piece. It is very musical. Even when we're the actual musical aspect of it, but the words are definitely a song.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing about the words, which was very interesting too, was the fact that the stage directions are spoken on stage. Which is, what did you guys think about that?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of times, you know, at first in this particular process, it was a little off-putting. Even though Theo and I have actually been in the previous production of Red and Brown Water, this particular production was interesting because we were so engrossing each other that sometimes it was hard to break that. But once we got into that, it's actually a tool that actually invites the audience into the show, makes them a part of the community. And that's something that's really strong in Terrell's piece and also in Shirley Jo's directing style, bringing the audience into it, allowing them to experience what we're going through as we're going through it. And in the first person, as opposed to someone just watching.
And I think that's important about the world, just that, you know, in this world that we play in, we don't get a break, so neither do you. I love it now. Yeah. I had a hard time adjusting to it, though.
And I do as well. For me, it reminds me that I'm a storyteller, and to keep the story going and to make it all inclusive.
Absolutely.
So it's really
important. Well, it's interesting because a lot of times people have been doing this in theater for a long time, this point about breaking down that fourth wall.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I mean, and it's interesting, I read a comment by Terrell where he was talking about that he actually was expecting people and hoping that it would encourage people to sort of shout out and yell back at what's going on the stage. Because he really did see this as a communal experience, which is really that thing. And when you think about theater and the way when you go all the way back, the way it actually served a function of helping people to deal with exactly the world as it is and how you wish it would be and all this other stuff. And being able to do this, I was thinking about when I was in Sri Lanka, there was one village, I don't know if this was common throughout, but there was one village where people sat around a gigantic flat drum. And they would have these times when they would come out and people would just play the drum, all the people in the village, and they would, then all of a sudden they would, you know, somebody would speak and other people, the drumming would go down and then people come out. It was a really amazing experience. And it was. Nice. They wove together a story that meant something for people at the moment, from the past to the present, or what they hope for the future. Yeah. And that's what I got in this as well, which was kind of heavy. One thing I wanted to talk about, the opening of the thing. Mm-hmm. Well, before we do this, because I could talk forever. What we're talking about, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking about a play that's called Brothers Size. And we're talking today with, you know, Gilbert, I'm going to forget you. It's Gilbert Glenn Brown. Mm-hmm. You had to have three names, didn't you?
Yeah. My parents.
Right, yeah. Gilbert Glenn Brown. My parents just said, you. Come on. Yeah. I was just glad it wasn't it. Anyway, we're talking today with Gilbert Glenn Brown, Matthew Hancock, and Theo Perkins, who are the cast of this play, The Brothers' Sighs. Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things that happens is you have this percussive dance that opens the play up. Mm-hmm. And it is so, I mean, one, it's really gripping when you see it. And what it establishes there in terms of people are zeroed in, but also almost everything that you're going to see emotionally in the play is there in one way or another, right?
Mm, yeah.
It also reminded me, have you guys ever seen the film Sankofa?
Yes.
Okay. That scene in Ghana where they're going into the slave ships, and it's just one face after another, but the drums behind it are body drums, they're body music.
Yes. Yeah.
And it just really brought me right there. And I think it's fitting for the theme of the play, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was the intention. That Amina Kaplan, who's our choreographer, she did a great job with this. And trying to, you know, establish and set up the story right away about our dynamics, our three dynamics. And traditionally, in the Yoruba tradition, a Legba begins all the rituals.
Yeah.
So what you saw was a Legba starting, you know, and you know, Ogun and Oshusi joining.
That's actually the process of the whole ritual, that it starts with a Legba, goes to Ogun, Shusi, and then so forth and so on up the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded us how everything is interconnected, how everything is related. It's a ritual, it's theater, but theater started with ritual,
right? Mm-hmm.
From ritual. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one thing that I also thought of in the course of this is, you know, the theme, and I know, I'm fanatical when I prepare for things. I try to read everything that's ever been written about something. Right? But I know there's been a lot of talk about sort of narrowing, I think actually in a certain sense, narrowing it down to just, you know, the relationship between the people and especially between the brothers. Mm-hmm. And it's true that that's sort of a fundamental thing there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of love in the thing with all the characters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not, you know, coming from different places, each of the two brothers and Alegba, you know, you're coming at it from different places and different things, but you're offering a different perspective on all this. Mm-hmm. And in the final analysis, what I was thinking about this morning, I kind of woke up at like 5 o'clock and said, oh my God, this is but the point about freedom,
which rings
so true today. Mm-hmm. And especially, I mean, I don't know if you were listening to the thing before.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you think about this, the total dehumanization and the lack of freedom. And, you know, I'd have to say, Matthew, I'd like you to talk about this a little bit, because your character is one who openly is really searching for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the other two characters are sort of relating to that in one way or another. Mm-hmm. But not just trying to force a choice, because then it comes back to you, you know, and Gilbert, your character, who at a certain point defines how even your brother's lack of freedom imprisoned you as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this whole question of the quest for freedom in the face of a terrible, terrible nightmare of a system, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Oshusi is actually, I wanted to call him the patron saint, but he's also the deity of the persecuted one. So that's in the story as well. But really, in searching for oneself and constantly falling into different traps, you know, I say in the show, I have sin on my mind, but not in my heart. So it's one of those things that it's the constant battle of battling yourself and then the way in which the world views you. Because, you know, we live in a world where the law tells you what not to, don't stand still and don't run. So then what are you supposed to do? And then to have that constant voice. And then you have the voice of family telling you to do one thing. You have your friends telling you to do one thing. And then still trying to find that voice for yourself, which I think is essentially Oshusi's, what do I have to say? Because you live in a world of chaos, you don't necessarily get a chance to, like, sit and ponder on that or even find that.
And it's also, again, it's tied into as well, I think, the whole point about this is a story about a people, a whole people, a section of humanity who actually were stolen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their whole existence in this country is based on the theft of their freedom and the idea that the dream about Madagascar in the book and the dream about the guy in Madagascar and that, in a certain sense, symbolizing and really putting out this freedom that doesn't exist for you anymore in the quest to find that. Very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, we're going to go right up to this. May be the last question, but there is something I wanted to talk about, because I want to read you this, and it has something to do with what happens between the three of you.
Mm-hmm.
There was a recent study in 2013. There was a study done by the Sentencing Project, I think, and they made in the study that one of the conclusions they came to is one of every three Black American males born today can expect to go to prison in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, because a lot of the question of freedom, it unfolds around –
Matthew, your character's coming out of jail and, mm-hmm. and in some ways just wanting to leave it behind and seriously marred by the experience. Mm-hmm. Legba, your character, who actually is sort of, in a lot of ways, is a hustler, but is also sort of trying to angle in different ways around the question of freedom. I mean, you offer up a lot of freedom mm-hmm. to Matthew's character. Right. And Gilbert, your character, who actually talks about being imprisoned by your brother's imprisonment. Mm-hmm. And your brother at the same time saying, stop asking me about prison because you're putting me back there. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this situation in terms of how you view. This point that I made is about one of every three black American males born today can expect to be in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, and how you would see that in terms of the play.
Hmm. that's heavy. Seeing it in terms of the play, I mean, it's unfortunately, it's a statistic, and unfortunately, it's true. I don't believe there's any one of us here today who hasn't had any interaction with the law on any level. And I think that in terms of the play, I think that the thing that's coming up for me right now is that community, and not just the neighborhood. I'm talking about globally, universally, that we all have to say, we can't let that remain true. We can't let those statistics become fact, and that because we become locked into that, mm-hmm. we become lined up with that, and that becomes our reality. But it doesn't have to be our reality. We can make another choice. Mm-hmm. We can decide, look, no, that's not true. It's this, it's this, it's this. We have other options. We have other roads. But if we follow that, we're going to continue walking down that path. And, you know, and sometimes we need a little push.
Well, you know, one thing that actually is interesting is because at the end, you actually, the way this is done is breaking out of mm-hmm. the chains that have been put on all of you, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it's very sad. I don't want to give everything away, but it really is. It's breaking those chains. And that's the thing, is because I think as long as we live in this kind of society, we ain't going to break out of this.
And as Gilbert said, it's about choices.
Except people who live under the threat of constant jailing and killing have very few choices when the society is geared towards. Right. You're just
superfluous.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're not even human. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. So unfortunately, we got to wrap it up. I could have talked to you for an hour, but we'll try to have you back. Anyway, let me thank all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
And I want to let people know that we've been talking with Gilbert Glenn Brown, Matthew Hancock, and Theo Perkins, the entire cast of the play, The Brothers' Sighs. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer for today, Henry Carson, my board op for today, Federico Garcia, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. And all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, do so at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with, I don't know what the song is now, but we're going out now. It's The System of a Lost Cause Man.
World so full. I will never be part of their system.